Here's a really special deal on a great product from our friends over at Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. You can now receive a $39 bottle of artisanal fresh pressed oil free if you just pay $1 to help cover shipping. And there's nothing else you must buy now or ever. It's a wonderful opportunity because with olive oil, my number one rule is the fresher, the better. That's because the olive is a fruit, and olive oil is actually a fruit juice. Like any other fruit juice, extra virgin olive oil is at its glorious peak of freshness, flavor, and nutritional potency when fresh squeezed. And that's what's missing with so many supermarket olive oils. After sitting on the shelf for months or even years, they've lost their freshness and can't compare with just pressed EVU shipped direct from the new harvest. Here at Milk Street, we really like these oils' vibrant, grassy flavors, as well as the intoxicating aroma, just like a garden in a bottle. Prove it yourself with no obligation to buy anything ever. For your free $39 bottle direct from an award-winning artisanal farm, go to getfresh177.com. That's getfresh177.com. One last time, getfresh177.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Jose Andres is, at his core, a great organizer. He runs 31 restaurants and has fed millions of people after natural disasters and in war zones. But he is, of course, also a chef with his own flair. For example, Jose would never make chicken stock without one special ingredient.
That flavor is that like kiss that your mom gave you before you fall asleep when you were a little kid.
Later in the show, Jose Andres shares his culinary secrets plus stories from World Central Kitchen. But first, we're taking a look inside the utensil drawer. Andreas Fabian is a silversmith with a particular interest in spoons. In fact, he was awarded a PhD for his research on spoons and spoonness. Unlike the rest of us, he pays attention to one of life's most commonplace objects. Andreas, welcome to Milk Street.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation.
You really like spoons a lot, I'll quote from you. People just don't think about spoons in their day-to-day lives. We question everything else in life, but we never question spoons. So how would you define a spoon, or how would you define spoonness in your words?
So a spoon is a really interesting object because it's a vessel and a utensil in one object. It has got a handle and it has got a bowl. So I think that's from a design point of view, the essence of a spoon. And I think especially the things we always take for granted, in my opinion, are normally the most interesting ones, like a paper clips and a nail and a pencil. I think when you look how influential a spoon or a pencil were in the history of mankind, they were probably much more influential than many, many other things.
Okay, so let's go back in time. So give us a brief history from, like, say, the Middle Ages on. How did the spoon evolve?
So basically, the first spoon, like we know it nowadays, is about 5000 BC, and I found it in Anatolia in Turkey, and some were found, I think, 6000 years in Egypt, and they were carved from bones or from ivory. And then until the Middle Age, the handles were very short because people were not holding the spoon between their fingers like they do nowadays. So in the past, they did it intuitively, like a child will do. And nowadays, we have to learn how to handle a spoon between our fingers. So it's not intuitively at all anymore.
So in other words, they pick up a spoon with in their fist.
In their fist, exactly, like a child, in their fist. But that, at that time, people didn't have the so-called table manners and etiquette and everything like that, which came from the 17th century from France. And that's also when they started to introduce the fork. And what I think is really, really interesting is that when etiquette kicked in, the handles on the spoons became longer and longer. So people always think that the handles became longer because of hygienic reasons, which is just not the case. The reason is because at that time, in the 17th century, everything became much more sophisticated at the royal court. So the language became more sophisticated, the furniture, the fashion, manners in general became more sophisticated, and that had an impact on the table culture as well. So the handles moved more and more away from the food. So that's another way of showing that we are not animals.
You know, it's so that's sort of interesting because I just finished a book about the courts in that time. And, you know, head lice were common. The teeth often would fall out or were black and were just horrendous. And, you know, they didn't bathe very often.
Yeah.
So there were some parts of that world which were very sophisticated, but other parts make me so glad I was not alive in the 1600s or 1700s, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a lot about the facade. It's almost like showing off.
Right, exactly.
But coming back to the royal court, what I personally find really, really interesting is when you think about the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles, I'm sure that the mirrors had an impact on our table manners because that was the first time we could see ourselves how other people would see us. So we started to control ourselves. The invention of a mirror was almost parallel to the development of tableware and etiquette. And I found that quite fascinating.
One thing that strikes me about some of your writing, I'll just quote, we go into a restaurant, just the notion that your spoon has been in the mouths of thousands of other people already is quite a disturbing thought. And
yes.
The whole idea of plates or spoons or utensils being private and public at the same time is something that's strikes you as interesting or odd, right?
Yeah. Because it's not only about public and private. It's about the intimacy of a spoon. There are not that many things we put into our mouths, but a spoon is one of them.
You're right. I mean, you wouldn't use someone else's toothbrush.
Yeah.
you do use someone else's spoon. So you designed a spoon based on some back and forth with a chef named Charles Michel. It's called the Goot Spoon. And it's similar in shape to a human finger. So how did that design come to life?
Yeah, I met Charles Michel. He's a wonderful cook, researcher, etc. So I asked him, what was the best compliment people ever made to you? And he said, when people lick the plate. And I thought, wow, great. And then we started to think, what else do people do when they do it privately? And one thing is they put their finger into creamy things and lick their fingers. And we thought, we want to bring the sensual pleasure back to the people and rather than moving them away from the food. Yeah? So we designed that good spoon, which is a bit like a drop shape. And when you put that in your mouth, you've got the food around it. And in a spoon, you have only got it in the bowl and just a tiny little bit underneath. Whereas the good, it goes around the form. Of course, you can't use the good for really liquid soups, but you can use it for creamy stuff.
One thing that strikes me, I know in West Africa, I was in Senegal a few years ago, when you're cooking, you took a little dab of food sort of on your hand or the back of your hand, and you lick it. And that's how you taste food as you're cooking it. And I started doing that myself, and the experience is totally different than if you just took a taste from the spoon itself. How you taste that food totally changes the taste.
Yeah. Which I think is brilliant because it reminds me of a movie I saw a few years ago. There was a little Indian boy invited to a German family And the first evening, they presented him a Western style meal and gave him fork, knife, spoon, and he just used his fingers. And then they said to him, yeah, why don't you use the fork and spoon? Yeah, but then I don't feel the texture of the food anymore. I don't feel the temperature of it anymore. It's a totally different experience, and I might not like it anymore. Yeah, and I find that really, really interesting. It's the intimacy, as you said, and also that's part of what we want to get back with our utensils we are designing.
So you mentioned a movie in your writings, Emily Eating Soup. What is that movie? I couldn't find it.
It's just a clip, basically. I wanted to film someone just using a spoon and eating soup. I just wanted to record the movement. But the key thing was, at the end, there was a drop. The drop dripped back into the plate, and that little drop at the bottom of a spoon affected her whole body language. Basically, we don't want that drop to drop on the tablecloths, we don't want it to drop on the clothes, and we take it to the public, and people say, oh, that person can't eat, has got no manners. And I find that absolutely fascinating, that one drop can change our whole body language.
You have little sort of folksy bits of information. Say, in Germany, when you die, the expression is, you give away your spoon. What does that come from? What does that mean?
When you think about the spoon, that's the very first eating utensil we are fed when we are young or babies. And it's probably the very last one when we are fed again just before we die. And basically in Germany, there's a saying, you give it away, you don't eat anymore, you just die. And sometimes when you go to graveyards, you can even nowadays, you can find sometimes that people put little spoons somewhere. So there are so many sayings about the spoon, which shows how important it is. The spoon is not only a practical thing to eat with, it has also got ritual function. When you think about christening spoons, yeah, or souvenir spoons, people buy spoons when they travel around the world and take them with them just as a souvenir and just look at them without using them. There are many collectors of spoons in the world.
Well, someday you may invent the ultimate spoon, and they'll call it the Andrea spoon, maybe, huh?
This is really interesting. I've always been asked, so Andreas, what's the ultimate spoon? I always say it doesn't exist. There might be ultimate spoons for different contexts. Yeah, it's always depending on the context. For what do I want to use it? Where do I want to use it? So we always need a certain variation.
Andreas, thank you. Beauty, simplicity, design, and philosophy all in one. Thanks so much.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
That was silversmith Andreas Fabian. He runs his own design studio in Berlin. Now it's time to answer your cooking questions with my co-host, Sarah Moulton. Sarah is, of course, the star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on public television, also author of Home Cooking 101.
So, Chris, before we get going here, I just was wondering, what is your favorite way to cook fish?
I have lots of ways. First of all, I've adopted Kenji Lopez Alts. This is the classic Japanese technique of salting fish.
Yeah.
And I do that overnight, especially with salmon. And so when you cook it, it doesn't have that smell. I mean, I cooked some salmon the other day and forgot to salt it, and I can still smell the salmon 3 days later.
So this is no skin on.
You do center
fillets.
Cut. Fillets,
okay.
Yeah. You salt them, let them sit, and then you cook them, and you don't get that white albumin because it holds on to the proteins, and it also concentrates the flavor and salts it. That's a great way to cook it. There are two ways I do it. I put it in a skillet with a little bit of liquid on lemon slices and parsley stems, steam it essentially for 10 to 12 minutes. That's a really simple thing, and you can make a sauce out of what's left in there. The other thing I do is use a stovetop sort of griddle. You heat it up for 2 or 3 minutes right on the stovetop. It's not electric. And without any oil or anything, you put the salmon right in there. You cook it. Flip it over halfway, takes maybe 3 or 4 minutes to cook. You get this incredible crust.
Mm,
it's just amazing.
Yummy.
You don't have to put it on a grill or anything else. It just works really well. So I like those two methods.
It's interesting you brought up salmon, because I meant any old fish, but you went right for salmon, which is, you know, yummy fish that we should all be eating a lot of anyway. And now I know the salt thing, I'm going to do that. But what I do is I get these parchment bags. I cook it in a bag.
Of course you do.
But I don't do the fancy folding, although I can. You know, the French thing, right. Fish en papillote. I put the salmon in with sliced chilies and orange and, oddly enough, rosemary.
That's
I don't know why. And oil-cured olives. And
rosemary's a bit odd.
It is. It's a very robust herb, but so is salmon.
That's true.
And then a that little bit good. Of orange juice, lemon juice, and fold up the bag. And the great thing about cooking it in the bag is, A, you can stick a knife right through the bag to see when it's done. But also, the house doesn't stink. If you cook it in a bag, it doesn't smell fishy.
That's it.
It's also yummy. I should have started there. I should have started there. It's so really
your
tasty.
Your new fish book is going to be The House Doesn't Stink.
There you go.
The art and practice of fish
cookery. The recipe is delicious. Okay, that too.
All right. All right. Let's take a call.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Anne in New York City.
Hi, Anne in New York City. How can we help you?
Well, my son and I went to Istanbul, and there were so many wonderful spices there that we brought home. And the one we liked the best when we were there was za'atar.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really know what to do with it now that we have it at home.
No.
Well, send it to us.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, I'm going to give this a shot, and then Chris is going to tell you 5 million ways to use it. But I'm just going to start.
Right.
So you know what it's made of. Za'atar is made of za'atar, which is a wild herb, sort of like wild thyme and maybe a little reminiscent also of oregano. And then it's combined with a few other things. Generally, those other things are sesame seeds and sumac. And sumac is very lemony. So essentially what you have is a spice mix that is both herbal and lemony. So anywhere you would like those two elements to be introduced to a dish, you should reach for the za'atar. You know, when you roast vegetables, when you roast a chicken, I'd add it to scrambled Ooh. Eggs, combine it with olive oil and drizzle it on bread.
Well, that sounds good.
You can put it on top of yogurt, get it into the oil and then put it on top of the yogurt or on top of hummus.
Oh.
Really just see it as a nice, herby, lemony spice mix.
I've sourced lots of different za'atars. They're really not very good. And Areem Cassis, who wrote The Palestinian Table, I visited her and her family in Palestine, and then her parents also live in Jerusalem. And her mother sent me a bag of, she picked the za'atar and made it herself.
Wow.
And it was like, oh my God, It was like the best thing I ever had in my life. It was phenomenal. I think we used it all up in about 4 weeks. So the difference between the real thing and what you get in the store, there's a big spice market. You go there?
Yeah, we went to the big spice market, and the person we were with brought us to sort of an alley behind the spice market.
Oh, okay.
To some guy he knows that makes.
Good for you, because I find that spice market, some of that stuff is not.
They have big tubs
fabulous.
Of it.
It was pretty touristy.
Yeah, it was very touristy.
Yeah,
so the good stuff is more. Secondly, it does have sumac in it and sesame seeds, other things, but I find that most of the tar mostly tastes like thyme/oregano. I use it as a base spice. Like, you know, if you go to a lot of places in the Middle East, every household has their own spice mix and they use it on everything.
Right.
Za'atar is a really wonderful sort of all-purpose thing. And I think Sarah's, you know, eggs, chicken. I put it on chicken every time I roast the chicken. It's great. Mm-hmm. I actually use it in tomato sauce sometimes.
Really?
Yeah. Think of it as a baseline foundational spice mix. You can use, you know, it goes on virtually everything. It goes on fish, it goes on chicken, it goes on meat, you can use it on anything. The quality makes all the difference, and the good stuff is not related to the not good stuff.
Okay.
So it sounds like you got the good stuff, So,
yeah, it does.
Yeah.
How much did you buy, by the way? Did you buy a big bag of it or a small bag?
You know, they vacuum sealed it so it would stay fresh
nice.
For us.
Yeah.
It's probably as big as a dinner napkin.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good. If you ever go back, you'll get one the size of a pillowcase because you'll realize how good it is. There was a wonderful social media thing a couple years ago, Reem sent it to me, of women from the Middle East tasting za'atar.
Oh, dear.
And they just were like,
horrified.
They just threw it out. It was like, this is garbage.
That is funny. I'm going to look up that, too.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. Anyway, it sounds like you got the good stuff, so.
Yay.
I hope so.
All
Thank
right.
you. I'll let
Thanks,
you
Anne.
Sure that.
All right.
Okay,
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. This is Milk Street Radio. If you're struggling with a recipe, give us a call anytime. Our number, 855-426-9843. One more time, 855-426-9843. Or you can email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Sharon Cantor from California.
How can we help you?
I have a crazy question. When my husband was sent to the store for evaporated milk, he tends to come home with condensed sweetened milk.
Right.
And now I have 4 cans. I have no idea what to do with them other than make desserts. So I would love to find some wholesome, healthful recipes for which one could use sweetened condensed milk.
The short answer is, if you want to actually use any substantial amount of it, other than for desserts, you're probably going to be hard-pressed. I mean, sweet and sour is common in most cuisines in the world. Mm-hmm. So you could have fish sauce for savory on one side and something sweet on the other. Uh-huh. But you're not going to use a can of it, right? So I can give you, though, a recipe. First of all, let's go back. Evaporated milk was invented by Borden back in the mid-19th century because a lot of kids died because fresh milk was full of bacteria and killed them. Right. Yeah. So this was a health issue, and that's why it was shelf-stable. You know, sweetened condensed is a sweeter version of that. But there's a lot of desserts, cakes, and other things in, let's say, Central America, Mexico, et cetera, which use the product because that, you know, in a hot climate, it's the safe way to go. There's a corn cake we actually did, I got from someone in Mexico City at a market that's made with condensed milk. It's made in a blender, the whole thing. And it's not particularly sweet.
Right.
You use fresh corn. It's amazing. It has this velvety, it's almost like a devil's food cake texture almost.
Wow.
It has corn flavor, but it's not overly corny. So I would go find something where you can use a whole can, the recipe, but it's not particularly sweet. It's also, you know, ice cream, if you want to make no-churn ice cream, a lot of those recipes are based on sweetened condensed milk.
Hmm.
But if you want to use up a whole can, I can't think of a really savory application where you would need more than a couple of tablespoons, I guess.
Right.
I mean, it's shelf stable, so I wouldn't get that. It's not like
I bet you. I bet you it might freeze well too after, because there's not a lot of water. I mean, it's like the water's
been
evaporated.
I'm sure it'll be fine in the can for
a while. Yeah.
Well, trust me, they've been there through at least one move already.
Yeah.
Well, Sharon, one thing you said, healthy. I think you have to throw that by the wayside, because it is, as you know, very, very, very sweet.
Yes.
So, you know, either use it in an application like Chris said in this cornbread. And is that in the magazine?
It's actually a corn cake.
What's it called?
It's
so
called,
she can find it.
I think, Mexican corn cake.
Mexican corn cake.
But it's one of my favorite desserts. It's also, it's a blender cake.
Right.
Basically, it takes 2 minutes to throw together.
Yeah. So that sounds like but I had another suggestion. Either Thai iced coffee or Thai iced tea.
Or Vietnamese iced coffee.
That too. I mean, yes, Southeast Asian.
That's a great idea. Hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah, but I agree with Chris. Those cans will last.
Just put the cans in your will. it's for the next generation.
Right there with fruitcake, huh? Yeah.
No, but this can actually ensure longevity. I can't die until all these cans are used
There
up.
You go.
Excellent.
So a tablespoon a year, I think.
I've been looking for a way to do this. That's really good.
Yeah.
That's great.
I'm going to go and buy lots of cans now.
Yes.
Just don't send them to California.
Just don't send them to California.
No. Okay, sure.
There you go.
Well, thank you so much for the call, and I appreciate your suggestions and recommendations. This is great.
Okay.
Take care. Bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.
This is Mill Street Radio. Coming up, the world according to Jose Andres. That's up after the break. I'm Christopher Kimball, and now here's a word from our friends at Allagash Brewing Company, who love food as much as we do here at Milk Street.
Hi, this is Jason Perkins. I'm the brewmaster at Allagash, and I've been making Allagash White in Portland, Maine since 1999. So a white beer is a very old style of beer. Traditionally, it was brewed with spices of some type, typically coriander and orange peel. And I think one of the things that makes Allagash White distinctive and different is the rare combination of complexity and drinkability. And it's sometimes remarkable to stop and realize that I never get tired of it. You know, I'll open a can or I'll pour a glass and the first sip and I'm like, man, this beer is good. There are a lot of different ways that folks can enjoy an Allagash White, and here are some of the examples of what folks here at the brewery like to do.
My favorite thing to pair with an Allagash White is simple, beautiful seared scallops over a bed of fresh greens with blood orange and shaved fennel.
My favorite would probably have to be like an Italian or a hoagie, capicola, pickled vegetables, crusty bread. It's got that nice lemony, zesty character that just gets you ready for the next bite.
The ultimate pairing for me is this dish called bosam, which is this like big pork shoulder with like salt and brown sugar. We also call it candy pork in my house, and a little like scallion ginger sauce. It's like lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, and it's just perfection.
My other top choice was like a hot dog. Like, just have a hot dog and have an Allagash White. You don't need to dress it up.
There's something about mussels with beer, especially the white, that is just so good.
I feel like it goes really well with different soft cheeses that aren't too dominant, but then also with like spicy Indian food. So I think it's just really versatile.
I could imagine like something like lemon meringue pie. That would be really nice.
Pairing Allagash White with carrot cake is a thing of beauty.
This maybe it sounds really boring, but pepperoni pizza. I feel like after a long week, having like a nice warm pepperoni pizza and a cold Allagash White is just like you made it. Like you did your week. You deserve this pizza. You deserve this beer.
It's perfect in summer. It's perfect in winter.
I haven't really found a flavor that I don't think works really well with Allagash White.
Yeah, so not only do I drink it while I cook, I often cook with it. So if I'm creating some kind of stew, I'll add a little bit of Allagash White to it.
A lot of people use Allagash White in like a fried fish batter.
Anywhere where you can add like a spritz of lemon or a spritz of lime, that could be the beer.
We are very food-minded here at Allagash, obviously. And I think because of that, Allagash White is kind of subtle in a way that not all beers are. And I think that makes it very food-friendly.
I think it tends to unlock qualities in the food that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily notice.
Like it's not too hoppy or it's not too sweet. So it sits right in the middle and sort of brings the flavors of the dish to life.
If you ask anyone here at Allagash, we're pretty much all stands for this beer. We love it so much because every time you have it, you pick up something new.
Every time you come back to it, you're reminded like, oh, wow, yeah, that's really good.
This is Jason Perkins again. Just want to say thanks to everyone at Allagash for sharing. You can try Allagash White at home, too. Head to allagash.com/locator to find Allagash White near you.
For 21 plus only, please drink responsibly. Allagash Brewing Company, Portland, Maine.
This is Most J Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Just hours after the earthquake in Turkey and Syria in 2023, Jose Andres arrived on site and started feeding people. In the last few years, he's also been to Ukraine, Hawaii, and most recently, Gaza. From natural disasters to war zones, Jose Andres and World Central Kitchen have served more than 350 million meals since 2010. Jose also somehow runs 31 restaurants, and his new book is based on his restaurant, Zatina, which has locations in New York, Washington, D.C., and also South Beach. Jose, welcome back to Milk Street.
Thank you. So happy to be back, Chris.
Let's talk about Asturias. You are from the north coast of Spain, Asturias. It is like Brigadoon. It's some amazing place, mountains, seashore. So my first question is, do you ever get the, you know, the feeling you just want to go back and spend some time there and relax? How do you live away from Asturias?
We can write an entire book about that. My father and mother met in Asturias. My father was a nurse, working in the mountains, going from little town to little town, taking care of the different villagers. Asturias is a region of 1 million people. In less than half an hour, you can be in some of the highest mountains in Europe. And you can be in less than an hour by the sea next to the fishermen. When I go back, I almost cry. Sometimes I will drive for 8 hours or take a plane from a very far away place, even if it's only to be 24 hours in Asturias. Mm.
So the first time you worked to serve people after a disaster of some kind or war, was Haiti the first? Your first time doing that?
In an emergency situation, yes. But the reason of me going to Haiti was not Haiti itself, but moments in my life before. Obviously, you know, I always been part of DC Central Kitchen, the organization that was founded over 35 years ago by a guy called Robert Egger, where we were feeding homeless ex-convicts, but also was a training school for people to become cooks, a place to fight food waste, and in the process feeding 10, 20,000 homeless a day in Washington, D.C. A great model. There I saw the power of food to change a community, to give dignity to the people that sometimes receive none. But then Katrina happened, the Superdome specifically. How we didn't have a response to feed 10, 20,000 people in the Superdome, because arenas and stadiums are full of restaurants that the only thing you need to do is open them up. Didn't happen. I saw it, but they didn't do anything about it. Thinking about it, then Haiti happened. And this is the moment I say, I have to go. In fires, you send firefighters. When you have to take care of the wounded, you send nurses and doctors. So the simple idea was, who will be the better people to activate in an emergency a powerful feeding response? And I came to realize that will be the cooks that we feed the few. We will be the same people that we will have the network and the knowledge to feed the many. That's very much what I began doing in Port-au-Prince, going to markets, buying the local food, going back to the camps, picking up some of the people that everybody wanted to volunteer. This way, I began making a few thousand meals a day. But what I realized is that the local community is always ready to be the first responders to help their own community. You don't have to look far away for the helpers. The helpers are all around you.
So the model before you started was to import the help and the food, right? And your model was to organize locally with kitchens that were available, people who wanted to volunteer, go to the markets, source things locally. So it was a local solution instead of some sort of imported solution to the problem, right?
When we can, that's what we do. Not always you can do local. In Ukraine, a country that feeds the world, exports food to feed closely to 400 million people on planet Earth every year. Wow. At the beginning, we were bringing food from outside. Why? Because the factories shut down, because they were in mayhem. Russia was invading. But very quickly, we realized that we were serving so many people that what if we help reopen the local factories, employing locally, leaving the money locally? This is the way that you have a smarter solution, because you empower the locals in the process. You are not only taking care of the problem, but you are already investing in a way in the reconstruction.
It seems to me that your ability to organize, which is really clear in how you run your restaurants, also applies to the World Central Kitchen. So you want to just talk about that just for a minute, because you have a keen ability to organize people and processes.
Well, yes, but one thing I know, that we have a tendency to plan. We plan too much. But what happens when things don't go as planned? Many people will freeze under the weight of the mayhem. If you embrace the complexity and you embrace adaptation, anything that happens, use it as an opportunity for you to come up with something new. Plans go away and adaptation wins the day. For World Central Kitchen, we're trying to feed people in Gaza. We're doing 350,000 meals a day. We've done more than 34 million meals. Still, we don't feel successful because it's many more than needs food, and we are not able to bring more food inside. We're not complaining. We're finding new ways to bring food into Gaza. We've been part of pushing for airdrops. Okay, 50,000 meals extra. They've been brought down every time food drops have happened. We're thinking about bringing food by boat into the beaches of Gaza. Why are we doing it? Because we want to be in the news? No. We are just coming up with ways that we can keep feeding people no matter what. You see, the mission wins. Feed everybody as quick as you can, bring water to everybody as fast as you can, and do whatever it takes to make it happen.
So let me just say thank you. I mean, your work with the World Central Kitchen is amazing. And you do it, which I have a hard time understanding, on top of running almost 36 restaurants and cookbooks. Your new cookbook, Sardinia, is about the Mediterranean. And there are a lot of, you know, really interesting recipes, but I have one in particular I'd like you to chat about, and that is when you make chicken stock, you add chickpeas. That's the first time I've ever seen that. So could you explain why you do that?
Seeing how big chickpeas are, obviously, especially because hummus and others in Lebanese cooking, you could argue Turkish, but even in Greek, for us was very logical to say, okay, how our chicken stock in a way can be not different, but can already be building on that flavor that in a way is the DNA of those regions. So because we were boiling so many chickpeas, we began realizing that why are we throwing that water away when the water is actually one of the best natural vegetable broths that you can have for anything. And I'm very happy that we made this decision many years ago, because now when I close my eyes, that flavor of chickpeas, it's almost like a kiss on the cheek. When your mom, before you go to bed at night, will come and will give you a kiss on the cheek, or she will pass her hand through the side of your face, I have a feeling like the aroma and the flavor of chickpeas is that like kiss that your mom gave you before you fall asleep when you were a little kid. That, to me, why chickpeas belong to our chicken stock.
Now you're a poet, too. You're just, there's always a new side of you. That was extraordinary. Another thing, you fry eggs in olive oil, which I see more and more. You want to just talk about that? Because I think that's a really great idea.
I love eggs, and I love fried eggs. And is this painting, from Velázquez? Which is not in Spain. If I'm right, it's in a museum in Edinburgh. Why is there? I don't know. But we should invade and take back our painting. But it's an iconic painting because it's this woman frying an egg in a terracotta casserole and with a wooden spoon, which is so traditional in Spanish traditional cooking, using wooden spoons, which actually is great because if you know how to use the wooden spoon, the egg white doesn't stick in the same way metal does. The egg white has love for metal. I think the egg white wants to have a ring out of metal, and nobody has ever give a ring to the egg white, and that's why the egg white always sticks to the metal. I think it's because nobody has ever offered to marry the egg white and a ring, and that's why it attaches to the metal when the metal is not hot enough. And that's why wooden sometimes works well. Even sometimes wooden also sticks, which this is another conversation. Long story short, egg white can attach to things because I think needs love. Because everybody loves the egg yolk and seems egg white is always on the side. Even now you go to LA and everybody wants an egg white omelette, which is changing. And I hope eggs realize that egg white is receiving equally the same love as egg yolk lately. But going back to the question you asked me, no country has more dishes with eggs than Spain. We adore eggs. Me, I like what we call huevo abuñolado, which will be like a fritter egg. That at the end what it is yes, the temperature of the oil is higher. Yes, you don't need much oil, but you need to make like a pool. Then you drop the egg, and very quickly when the oil is hot enough, the egg white itself, because how hot the oil is, almost at the edge of the beginning of a smoky point, it starts opening up, forming those bubbles that began growing up like it was a crazy souffle going mad. And in that moment, if you're quick enough, with a quick move right and left and with the help of that spoon, you make sure that egg white starts cover the top of the egg yolk that is always unprotected. At the end, what you have is a crunchy Maillard reaction crispy dehydration exterior of the egg with a nice softer egg white inside and with a very slightly warm but still liquidy egg yolk. Mm. I love to do those eggs because I like that challenge that almost you are at the edge of failure. But the day I do, wow, I feel so satisfied.
It's interesting because I heard a story about the Top Copy Palace, you know, a long time ago. They had, what, 50 or 60 resident chefs. And to get hired, the one dish you had to make were breakfast eggs. That was it, just eggs. And that was your test, that if you couldn't do it, you weren't hired.
Well, it's like a French omelette. You know, I remember I met Jacques Pepin so many years ago. And my God, that guy could cook. But the place I saw he was a genius of geniuses was when I saw in a cooking class in Aspen how he made a French omelette with such a simplicity that I know everybody felt like they could do it. But this guy was a genius.
The way he bangs the handle and gets it to flip is
Oh my God.
Amazing.
And listen, I think I make a very damn good French omelette because I made many in my life since my Navy days and before. But I was always so impressed the way a guy like Mr. Chef Jacques Pepin could get two eggs and a little bit of butter. I forgive him for using the butter. And the way he will achieve, that's a matter of what pan you give him. Everybody else will complain that the eggs are sticking to the pan. I don't know if he speaks to the pan or the pans know he's Mr. Jacques Pepin, like he's the Santa Claus of culinary world and nothing wrong will happen with him. That's a matter of what's the pen. Every other mortal, the eggs will stick to the pen. You can give him any pen. He will never get his eggs for the omelette to stick to the pen.
I want to end with a quote from you, which I really like, which is, too often charity is about the redemption of the giver, when in fact it should be about the liberation of the receiver. You want to just talk for just a minute about that, because I was struck by that.
I wish that was my phrase. I repeat that phrase so often. That phrase came from Robert Egger, the founder of This Is Central Kitchen. And I was roughly 24 when he told me that. It's okay you do things because you feel good about it. But at the end of the day, it's about being unselfish. It's about recognizing that to give will always be much more powerful than to receive. We receive so much that we are surrounded by things we don't know what to do with them anymore. But that when you give, in a way you feel you are emptying yourself out. In a way is when you are becoming weightless, and that being weightless is what liberates you and allows you to really have an impact in the life of others. So that phrase really was very important. I think I grew up understanding the power of that phrase. I don't even think Robert understood the power of the phrase when he told me that. I think he understood, but I don't think he understood that that phrase is one of the great phrases of humanity.
Jose, you're now a poet, a scholar, a chef, a humanitarian. The list keeps growing. It's really been a pleasure having you here and chatting with you. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, you waited for so long to invite me again to your podcast. I don't know. I don't know if it was my accent or what was going on here.
Take care.
Thank you, Chris. I love you.
That was Jose Andres. His new book is called Zatina, Delicious Mediterranean Dishes from Greece, Turkey, and Lebanon. Experts say that we can feed 10 billion people. That's 2 billion more than the world's current population. Although there are many critics of modern agriculture, our ability to produce more food per acre turned Paul Ehrlich's 1960s bestseller, The Population Bomb, into fiction. Today, the problem is not agriculture. War and politics are the two main reasons that populations starve. And these problems appear intractable until Jose Andres asked a very simple question. Why not use local resources, kitchens, chefs, and food producers to feed the local population in a crisis. So in a world that seems headed into darkness, it turns out that the impossible, that is feeding the world, is actually doable. The solution is simple. Get up early in the morning and just do it. This is Mill Street Radio. After the break, Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett reveal the secret language of restaurants. That's coming right up. You know, I grew up with Vermont farmers who made do with tools they had on hand. A hammer, pliers, and baling twine, of course, for most jobs. When I became a cook, however, I found that having just the right knife or maybe the perfect carbon steel skillet made all the difference. And the right tool also added pleasure to my cooking. I truly enjoyed my time prepping as well as cooking food. And that also goes for a car. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. And that includes available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hey, this is Chris Kimball, and I need your help. We're working on a story about the battles we all have in our home kitchens. Maybe you're tired of your partner telling you how to cook, or maybe they always leave a mess, or maybe you're frustrated by your loved one's highly restrictive diet. We want to hear about your kitchen dramas, from the biggest food fights to your everyday grievances. You can leave us a voicemail at 617-249-3167, 617-249-3167, or send a voice memo to radiotips@177milkstreet.com. One more time, call us at 617-249-3167 or email us a voice memo at radiotips@177milkstreet.com. Please include your name and where you're calling from, and thank you. I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Now let's head into the kitchen with Lynn Clark to talk about this week's recipe, Brazilian-style chocolate-glazed carrot cake. Lynn, how are you?
I'm doing well, Chris. How are you?
You know, a couple years ago, I came across a blender cake recipe in Mexico, corn cake. And it got me thinking, like, are there other blender cakes around the world? And we found one, a Brazilian-style carrot cake. It's not anything like the carrot cake of the 1970s, my best decade. But it is fabulous, and it's made in a blender. So how does it work?
It's a really great concept, and this is a really significant part of cake making in Brazil. They do it with corn, they do it with coconut, passion fruit, and in this case, carrots. And I'm not sure why we don't do this more often, because it really simplifies cake making. This is kind of very different than what you would think of when you think of carrot cake. The first reason is it's a bundt cake. It's not a three-layer confection with cream cheese frosting. It will get a glaze. And the second thing is that it is orange. It looks like carrot.
Amazing.
And that's because they use a really great method to make the cake by using the blender. So everything goes in the blender, all the wet ingredients, including chunks of carrot. And those carrots get just pureed up. And we didn't realize how much that was going to impact kind of the flavor and the texture of the cake. But when you really break root vegetables down like that, it kind of ruptures their structure, and then it gives off more sugar and more really strong flavor compounds. So you get really intense natural sweetness from carrot and the earthiness, and then also more moisture. So it's a really moist cake. And then that just gets whisked together with the dry ingredients. So really, really simple process.
Yeah, it also uses oil instead of butter, another trend I've been thinking about a lot, because oil gives you a cake that's moister and also lasts longer. Butter tends to dry out, so that's another reason it's tender. We should also say the texture is unlike carrot cake. It's not coarse. It's extremely fine, right?
Right, exactly. Part of the reason why that is, you know, a lot of these cakes are made with dairy, sometimes sour cream. But we chose to kind of lean into the tropical nature of this Brazilian cake and use coconut cream, which is that sort of heavy coconut thing you find in the can that you make a pina colada with. What we found when we added that to the cake is not only did we get that really nice coconut flavor, but it made the cake really nice and fluffy and light, which was good because we had all these carrots adding so much moisture. We had the oil adding so much, you know, moist texture that it really nicely balanced out all of those other, you know, more wet ingredients.
So just think, if I had this recipe back in the 70s, you know, I would have been popular then.
Yeah, you'd have a whole different idea of what carrot cake is.
Completely would have changed my life. And finally, the chocolate glaze, which really, you know, at first I was going, chocolate? But it works really well with this cake.
It is really nice here. And, you know, you do sort of think chocolate, a carrot cake, it's not what we think of, but it doesn't mean it's not delicious. We also sort of added a little bit of orange flavor here, too, to kind of highlight that color. You know, like you look at it, you're like, orange. And nothing is better than chocolate and orange together, I don't think. So we add a little bit of orange juice, some semi-sweet chocolate, and then a little bit of oil for shine, and cool our cake, and then put that over the top. And it's really important to cool this glaze down to room temperature so that it will slide over the cake, but not just completely slip off the cake. And then I think the best part of this cake is traditionally done with some very colorful sprinkles on the top. So it makes it really cute.
Cute.
It's very festive.
It does look cute. And it's extremely delicious. So Brazilian-style chocolate glazed carrot cake, a totally different way of doing it, but in a blender. And I think, you know, over the next year or two, we should come up with more blender cakes, because it just makes it so simple and I think actually better. Thank you, Lynn.
You're welcome. You can get the recipe for Brazilian-style chocolate glazed carrot cake at milkstreetradio.com.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Right now, let's check in with Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett, hosts of Away with Words. Hey, Grant, Martha, what's going on?
Hi, Chris.
Hey, Chris. Today we're thinking about restaurant lingo, you know, all that colorful language behind the scenes that makes a kitchen run a lot more smoothly, but maybe mysterious to its customers.
But if you're thinking about Adam and Eve on a raft, just hold your horses, because when those listicles make the rounds with all the colorful diner slang, most of it is invented for the fun of it by people who did not work in kitchens.
Oh, so the real stuff is grittier, you mean?
Well, it's plainer. People in kitchens don't tend to say moo juice for milk, you know?
And it makes sense that in a situation where every second counts, you're going to develop your own shorthand. But sometimes they do get picked up by mainstream English.
You can go to just about any restaurant in the United States, or North America for that matter, that can serve eggs. And if you say sunny side up, they will know what you mean. And that is old restaurant lingo from the 1880s.
So I have a question. Like, Sunny Side Up is charming, but it's a little longer. You could just say, you know, yolk up or whatever. You could make a shorter version. But I think some of it is it because there is sort of a certain charm or it sounds good too?
Yes, it's also an easy way to explain this concept that you're only cooking the egg on one side. You know, everyone understands the meaning of it. Also, that alliteration, even though there are more syllables, makes it go faster. By the way, in several European languages, they call them mirror eggs, which originally probably came from French.
And I love the fact that in Romanian, it's ua ochiri, which is eye eggs. You know, you get up in the morning and you haven't had your coffee yet and you're trying to cook these eggs and they're looking back up at you.
Well, that one kind of makes sense, but I would gather there's some expressions you have to actually think about because it's not really clear right at the beginning.
Yeah, so there's a whole ton of that stuff. I think everyone understands in the weeds now, wouldn't you say, Martha?
Sure, yeah. If you're in the weeds, you're slammed, basically.
Yeah, maximum capacity, and we're not sure where the weeds comes into this. It could be golf, where your ball goes into the rough and doesn't stay on the green, or more likely it had to do with letting your garden go, you know, letting it go to weeds
because
you're not keeping up with it.
But, you know, I do like some of those expressions that did get reprinted in newspapers. I mean, like stars and stripes. Did you ever have a plate of stars and stripes, Chris?
No. What's that?
That's pork and beans.
Stars and stripes.
And what about some roly-poly, Chris? If I served you roly-poly, what would...
Well, that's kind of like a cake roll or something.
Oh, you did know it. Yeah. Well, it's not exactly right. What we found in our glossaries is strawberry pudding.
Yeah,
and another one is summertime. For some reason, I have no idea why, summertime supposedly meant oatmeal.
What?
Serve me up a bowl of summertime.
There is one bit of restaurant lingo that's left the restaurant world, and that's 86, meaning there's nothing more. There's nothing left. The menu item is completely depleted. And you will find in other industries where they'll talk about somebody being 86, meaning they were kicked out of the establishment. Or any kind of inventory that's short. We're 86th on the nuts and bolts, you know?
So does anyone know where that came? How did that start?
Alas, they do not.
We thought you might ask that.
No, nobody knows the origin. There are a lot of theories, but as is usually the case when there are a lot of theories, there's no evidence to support any of them very fully.
I like that one.
And another one is camper. You can probably guess what a camper is in a restaurant.
No.
It's also used in video games, if that helps.
Nope.
Well, a camper is somebody who stays too long at the table. You know, having a great time.
I thought you were talking about a food dish.
Oh, no.
Oh, like s'mores or something?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, my favorite thing is at a restaurant where you're having a particularly good time and the food's great and the company's great and they obviously have another table booked.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just love what they do. There's some places where they obviously ask you if you'd like another cup of coffee or something. But then they start taking away the salt and pepper. Have you ever had that happen?
Ooh.
That's my favorite. They start removing things from the table quietly.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I do understand if you come in and someone says, look, you know, we got to turn the table, we can seat you now, but, you know, you have to leave by 9, that's fine.
Yeah, and that's another bit of restaurant lingo, to turn a table.
Yeah.
Turn and burn. Mm-hmm. It means to get those customers in, serve them, and get them out.
The restaurant business is a hard business.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So I have great sympathy for
people.
Oh,
yeah, the margins are thin, and the failure rate's high, and the work is hard.
Yeah, it is.
And I've only ever worked in fast food, but even there, we had our customs and our rituals and our lingo.
Wait. So where did you work?
It was a Hardee's, a fast food restaurant in Missouri.
Really?
Yeah, I was the best grill master in Troy, Missouri. A tourist bus would roll in. Somebody would shout, bus! And I would stack them high and stack them deep, and I could get the burgers out.
Man, that's stack them high and stack them deep.
So, Grant, I assume that you weren't a shoe.
Oh, no. You know shoe, Chris?
No, I don't know that one.
It's a bad cook.
Really?
Bourdain says in his book that sometimes people call them army because they cook like an army chef, high volume, low quality.
A shoe.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Chris, we're hoping that all of your dinners in the future out at restaurants will be shoeless.
And I hope that no one steals the salt and pepper as I sit there nursing my cold coffee.
Right. Then you wouldn't be a happy camper.
I knew that was coming. Well, Grant, Martha, once again, we plumb the secrets of the origins of words, and this time a little behind the scenes in the restaurant world. Thank you.
Oh, it's our pleasure, Chris. We'll see you next time.
Bye, Chris.
That was Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett, hosts of Away With Words. That's it for today. You can find all of our episodes at milkstreetradio.com or wherever you get your podcasts. You can learn more about Milk Street at 177milkstreet.com. There you can become a member, get all of our recipes and access to all live stream cooking classes, plus free standard shipping from the Milk Street store and more. You can also find us on Facebook at Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, on Instagram at 177 Milk Street. We'll be back next week with more food stories and kitchen questions, and thanks as always for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with GBH. Co-founder Melissa Baldino, executive producer Annie Sinsbaugh, senior editor Melissa Allison, senior producer Sarah Clapp, associate producer Caroline Davis with production help from Debbie Paddock, additional editing by Sydney Lewis, audio mixing by Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, theme music by Chewbop Crew, additional music by George Brindle Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.